The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Entangling Vines Koan Collection. Once at the time of the Buddha, seven wise women were taking a walk through a charnel ground. The eldest pointed to a corpse and asked the others, "The corpse is here, but where is the person gone?" One of the younger women replied, "What's this? What's this?" The other women all saw clearly and attained enlightenment. This is a collection that comes from the Linji school that is... It's not much is known about its compilation, but these a lot of the koans come from the other classical collections, Miscellaneous and Blue Cliff Record and Book Serenity. And there's just a verse, I mean just the case. There's no verse, no commentary, no pointer. The corpse is here. Where's the person gone? We end each evening remembering that life and death are of supreme importance. When a student enters the Zendo for the first time as a student, they say, "I come here realizing the question of life and death is a vital matter." Why does Buddhism so emphasize this? One of the things I appreciated when I first encountered the Dharma was how it spoke of and seemed to turn towards things that we would rather not turn towards, how it acknowledged what we'd rather deny. There was something very refreshing, very affirming in that. Fearless to face what we'd like to avoid. If you're lost in the woods, the first thing that we need to do is acknowledge, "I'm lost." If we're sick with an illness, we need to acknowledge, "I'm sick," so we can take the next step. Where's the person gone? Spring brings life to the mountain. Summer is rich and verdant. Fall gives us a dazzling display. Winter is cold and quiet. These cycles, earth cycles, cycles of creatures, cycles of life, birth and death, coming and going. It's an ancient cycle. It's eternal. It's universal. It's inescapable. Why do we fear this? The Buddha wanted to know why these essential realities, true for every living thing, but as human being, why do we fear this? And fearing, what do we then put our trust in? What do we turn towards? What do we rely upon? Well, there are different ways that Buddhism speaks of that, but if we think of it in terms of desires, there's desires for just sensory experience, sensory pleasures, right? It's the thing about pleasure. It's pleasurable, right? Things that feel good, right? It seems built in. Right? It seems to have a purpose, right? Things that are not good don't feel good, right? And so there's a sort of evolutionary, biological intelligence to that. You know, don't go towards the things that are not good for you. Go towards the things that are. But then, you know, we get that all mixed up. So much so that when we enter the training in Buddhist practice, that the teachings are there to actually help us understand what actually is good. What actually should I be moving towards? What is skillful? Something we don't always know. And then there are the desires for existence, just to be. And then Buddhism teaches us the desire for non-existence, and I've seen that present its different ways. Whether it's the desire for non-existence in this moment, because existing, being, this mind, these patterns, these attachments, I would just like to be done with them. And it's sort of extreme, could be the desire to cease to live altogether. A baby's born, a human being is brought into this world. Human consciousness that is a toddler, adolescent, youth, young adult, middle-aged, old person. And there's a sense that there's somebody in that person that is that person that maintains themselves, that person, all the way through. You know, when you think about yourself as a child, you don't think, who was that stranger? They had my name, but why'd they have my name? They weren't me. We don't think like that. We think that was me when I was young. This is me now. When I'm older, I'll be me older. But what about when I die? What happens to me then? Where does me go? There's a practice in the old times, in the Buddha's time, of practicing within a charnel ground where people who had died would just be laid out. They're, in fact, very, very detailed, more detailed than you might want, meditations to meditate on a corpse as it is actually decomposing. And the Buddha is very explicit with this, different stages that the corpse goes through as it basically is disassembling. And the teaching or the practice of that was to both recognize, because he said we kind of get fooled by the packaging, right? Which is kind of nice. It is nice, right? But that we think that's all it is. And so it's sort of like, okay, well, take off the package and what is it? Well, it's, you know, kind of gooey and smelly and all kinds of stuff. And to sort of, you know, disenchant us, our attachments, you know, not just with the body, with the body as me, and my clinging to the body as me. Because you know what? It's going to get older, and that body's going to change. It's going to get sick. It's going to change even more. It's going to die. Now it really changes. And so that attachment to the body itself is primordial, ancient, I think we can imagine. And so these practices were to sort of address that directly. Those didn't travel so well when Buddhism left India. Asian practitioners didn't seem as enamored of that practice as in the Buddha's time. Non-attachment to the self, this sense of self. So there's someone, if you think of it, that is listening right now to this talk, right? There's a sense that there's someone in your body that is listening, hearing, reflecting, reacting. There is someone who is sitting on your cushion. There is someone who will afterwards chant and bow, and then that someone will go downstairs and have lunch and so on, all through our lives. And the Buddha said, yeah, it does seem like that. It sure does. It seems like that to everybody. And so we take it as a kind of inarguable, you know, something that doesn't even need to be argued. It just seems self-evident to the self. You know, if you look up self in the dictionary, in a Western dictionary, it's got a very, very long passage section. There are many things that are associated with the self. Many things where the self is the prefix of something more. It's at the center of things. And it's understandable. It is our actual experience. I'm looking out at you. Well, you're not me. I'm looking out at you. And there's the distinct experience that someone's doing that. I'm doing that. And that you're looking back at me. So there's must be going on both ends. And what the Buddha realized is that that sense of self is just that. It's just a sense of something. You're sitting and you become aware of yourself sitting. That's a sense of something arising. It's like a sensation. It's a perception. And the Buddha said, that's all it is. It's a perception. It is something our mind does. It's something we experience in the mind. And that we impute into that a sense of a reality, a permanence, an essence, something that exists in and of itself. It keeps showing up. How could it not? And the Buddha said, as soon as that arises, then you have everything. Everything that we see now in the human world, you have. Because there's a boundary. And that sort of essential priority of that self is not just to live and survive, but to be. To be. And to establish itself in beingness. And then having this self, being this person in this boundary, what do I do with all of you? What do I do about that? Particularly if you infringe, right? Particularly if you do something or say something that seems to threaten me, right? You offer some helpful criticism. Oof! Right? Something is hurt. Evelyn Underhill in the book in that we recently studied on mysticism, she says, what is it about human nature that when we experience something that is hurtful, that event comes and goes, it's gone in an instant, but the self continues to be hurt. Something is hurt and continues to be hurt long after the cause of that injury is gone. That's the self. A sense of self. So the Buddha realized that is empty. It doesn't exist like that. It exists in the way we experience it, as a perception that comes and goes, but it doesn't exist as anything more than that. And so that's why Buddhism, there's a lot of teachings and practices of turning towards, facing, remembering what we want to forget. Time swiftly passes by. Opportunity is lost. I remember being a child, young person, and waking up every morning to hear my father, who was a heavy smoker, hacking, coughing all of it out. And at one point, I remember I was a teenager, I was laying in bed listening to that morning ritual and thinking, he thinks he's going to live forever. I hadn't encountered Buddhism before, but it just seemed like, I mean, I didn't understand addiction. I didn't understand how addictive cigarettes were. I just thought, he's making a choice. And why would he choose that unless he thought he was going to live forever? And so there are meditations of visualizing yourself, your person, in your deathbed, dying. To just hold that in your mind. Right? What happens now? In your dying process, just to visualize that. You're not there to fix anything, it's just a mental image. But we create mental images all the time that seem very real to us. We react to them, we talk to them, we act out of them. So now you're employing that, but deliberately, mindfully, and for a good purpose, to face that inevitability that we would rather not, and to try and make it real in our mind. And then to take it a step further and visualize yourself as that corpse. Lifeless. And if you've ever been with someone who is in the dying process, very close to death, unconscious, not responding, not reacting, not giving any of the signs of life other than breathing, which is becoming increasingly erratic, and then that moment when life seems to have departed, and the dramatic shift of that, even when the person is unconscious and is completely still, unmoving, unresponsive, the very palpable change, when it seems as though something has left. What is that? So Buddhism understands that as consciousness. And it's not you, it's consciousness. It is the continuity that has been going on forever. And in different lives has been assuming different forms and continues because it has no end. But it's not the self, it's not the person. So here, when the elder says, the corpse is here, but where has the person gone? Where is that person? Where is that self? And another nun says, what's this? What's this? And they're all enlightened. So the student of that koan has to enter into that. What's this? It's not intellectual. It's not conceptual. It's not an idea. What's this? The Buddha said we impute a sense of self into this body. This is who I am. I am. I exist. I am this. This is mine. And then I extend that to my possessions, my relationships, whatever I want to belong to me. To ask where has the person gone can already imply that there's a person. They've gone somewhere. Let's go find them. Right? Are they a ghost? Are they in heaven? Or are they in Buddha heaven? Or are they in Buddha hell? Buddhism has hells. They're like pretty juicy hells, really. Buddhism lacks no imagination in the hell realm. It has multiple hells, all kinds, for all kinds of lives. You don't want to go there. Even the best one, you don't want to go there. I'm telling you. There was a poem that Mizumi Roshi liked very much. I think it was sort of taken as his death poem. It's something, I'm paraphrasing, I couldn't find it, I don't remember it completely, but something like, after I die, you can call, but I won't answer. I won't have gone anywhere. And yet we do take care of this body, this Buddha body, because it's your vehicle, it's your vessel. Take care of it. Right? It's the body you practice in, you meditate in, you love in, you work in, you do good for the world in. But what about those attachments we have to it? That attachment to self, and of course our culture, society, you know, companies, businesses want us to be attached to the body. It's good for sales, right? So we glorify youth, we disparage aging, but you know, the funny thing about aging, I heard somebody say, you know, nobody wants to get older, but it's the club you actually want to be a member of. Right? Nobody wants to be excluded from that club. But where's the person? Where did the person go? So some people resolve that, but or try and resolve it by wanting to live forever, right? That's probably been going on for as long as maybe forever. Wanting to live beyond, right? It's okay, I'm going to die, but I can keep living, right? Somewhere, somehow. Or just not wanting to let go of this life. A very important experience I had when I was a teenager was I had an uncle who was, you know, had some good qualities, in many ways was not a very nice person. He lived kind of harshly. And he was dying. He was dying of cancer. And he was dying. Everybody knew it. He was in the hospital. He was in his deathbed. He was not having it. Don't talk to me about death. I'm not dying. He was not having it. And he would not die all the way to his death. And that was a very powerful experience for me. It's like, oh, that's a way to go. And the aftermath of that was because he didn't accept his dying. He did not do certain things to take care of people who had given him a better life, like his wife. He would not do certain things. So she suffered quite unnecessarily after he died because of his clinging, self-clinging. That's the nature of karma. Where is the person? Dogen says, the great way of all Buddhas thoroughly practiced is emancipation and realization, liberation through realization. Then he says, emancipation means that in life, you are emancipated from life. And in death, you are emancipated from death. Well, everybody lives and everybody dies. So what is he talking about? He says, there is detachment from life and death and entering into life and death. This is the complete practice of the way. There is letting go of life and death and vitalizing life and death. This is the thorough practice of the way. And so we can speak of emancipation as to be free of all of the various forms of our greed and our anger, our pride and jealousy, all the things that bind us, the kleshas, that we act out of and cause all kinds of trouble. Our false views, our confusion, our indifference, so on. Indifference is non-attachment, not attaching. It's not grasping. It's being free of anxiety, free of trying to control. It's not clinging to inner experiences, not clinging to outer experiences. It's not clinging to this self. It's not clinging to others' selves. Detachment doesn't mean distant. It doesn't mean cold. It's immediate. It's right here. It's just not clinging. And he said, and so there is vitalization, that when we let go, there's vitalization. Attachment has a dampening quality. It dampens, right? Because our attachments are constricting. It's like trying to stuff something alive into a box to domesticate it, control it, to know it, to have it, right? And so it loses its vitality. It becomes dim. It becomes distant. It's our holding on that causes things. When we let go, there is no box. It becomes vibrant. It doesn't become vibrant. We just experience it in its vibrancy. And so he said, from within life and death, we are liberated from life and death. It's the only way. We think we'll be liberated from death by never dying. I mean, think about it. If you had the choice to live forever, would you take it? Think about that. Would life be sweeter? More precious? Would you use it better if you knew that there were an endless, infinite number of tomorrows? What the hell does today matter? Right? You've got forever tomorrows. This is a complete practice, Dogen says, which means it requires a complete person. I mean, think about when we're fearful in our lives, when we have anxiety. And I think I will propose that if we really pay attention carefully, we'll see that there is a very subtle, sometimes not so subtle, deep underlying anxiety of existence. Because we know it doesn't last forever. We already know that. And we respond to that in a whole host of ways, many of them not so helpful. So think, if we acknowledge the fear of death, of life, then it's hard to enjoy life, right? Because we're fearful. It's hard to experience it because it seems to get in the way. It's hard to be free because we're not. And then, of course, it's going to be hard to face death. How can we face death if we haven't really engaged and understood life? And then what if we're afraid of death? It's going to be hard to live, right? It's going to be hard to grow old. It's going to be hard to experience illness. It's going to be hard to be with others as they are getting sick and growing old and dying. It's going to be difficult to be joyful in life because there's this specter that has not been examined, not been attended to, that is basically is not understood. That's what the Buddha said. We fear it because we don't understand it. I mean, one way of thinking about death is, you know, it's a pretty august group that has preceded you, right? Right? Some notables there. Not the first time. There's another koan from this collection in which a poet went to see a master, Huaitang. And Huaitang said, you know the passage in which Confucius says, my friends, do you think I'm just hiding things from you? In fact, I'm hiding nothing from you. And then the Zen master said, it's just like this in the great matter of Zen. Do you understand? And the poet said, I don't understand what you're talking about. So later they were out walking in the mountains where the air was filled with the scent of locust blossoms. And Huaitang said, do you smell the fragrance of those blossoms? And the poet says, yes, I do. And Wei Tong said, "You see, I'm hiding nothing from you." Later, the poet came to visit again, and Wei Tong said, "I'll die, and you'll die, and we'll end up burnt into two heaps of ashes. At that time, where will we meet? Where will we meet?" And the poet didn't understand. And it said that later on, he was on a trek, and he woke up from a nap, and as he woke up, he saw it. He realized it. Where will we meet? Again, we so easily fall in. You know, Buddhism acknowledges, the Buddha recognized, the deepest, most persistent belief that we have is in me and you, in the self. He said it's, you know, all of the different things that we disentangle ourselves from and free ourselves from and realize as empty, and even realizing that the self is empty, directly experiencing that and experiencing that again and again, it will continue to arise. I remember reading an old but contemporary master who said, you know, "I have seen that the self is empty. But every time I stub my toe, ow, I hurt." How could Wei Tong hide the scent of the blossoms? They're there for everyone. Everything is like this. When the mind becomes more clear and settled, the world appears more vital, more alive, more immediate, unhidden, undulled, here, here, here. Dogen says, realization is life, life is realization. At the time of realization, there is nothing but life, totally actualized, made actual. Nothing but death, totally actualized. I remember when my dad was coming close to the end of his life, he had cancer, and it was not a good prognosis. He knew he was going to die of it. And we met one time, and he was very anxious, very frightened. He was afraid of how he was going to die. He was afraid of being in a lot of pain. And he was feeling very vulnerable. He said, "I don't know how to do this." He said, "I've never done this before." I said, "I know." And I said, "But you know, I think if you can be here now with this, and then you keep doing that, just be here," right? Because he had been an alcoholic for much of his life, so his habit was to not be here. It was to dull himself, to turn away, to deny that, right? And so I said, "If you can just be here, and then keep doing that, I think at the time of your death, you'll know what to do." Right? I wasn't going to give him instruction in Zazen. I didn't want to offer him a teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha's teachings have complete integrity, and you don't need to use any language. Of course, to be here, because we have such a habitual impulse to not be here, we have to train ourselves. That's why we've been talking about mind training during the weekend. I can recognize I need to be here. I keep going away. I'm turning away. I'm fearful. I don't want to experience this. I need to be able to be mindful, but I don't. I can't, because I haven't developed that. Right? I can have moments, but they're fleeting. And then the fear takes over. So I need to develop the capacity to actually do that. That's what training and practice are. Dogen says, such activity makes life holy life. It's a complete practice, Dogen says, for a complete person. It makes life holy life. Nothing is missing. Nothing has been dimmed. It's not dull. And it makes death holy death. You know, practitioners, students that I've talked to who are approaching their death and sometimes are experiencing pain or are on medication, and they want to be alive into their dying. I've had students who said, "I don't want to miss this. I don't want to dull this. I want to be present. I want to be able to experience, to practice into this." I'm hiding nothing from you, Huaitong said. To be a complete person, to practice with your complete mind, to not divide, to not separate, to not be. The Buddha said, when you're sitting, don't think, I am sitting, I am meditating, I am concentrating, I am letting go. Right? Because that's just re-establishing, reaffirming, strengthening the sense that there is a self and that there needs to be. Like, because we could think, well, how the hell is all this happening if there's not a self? How could I have done all of this in my life without a self? You just did all of that without a self. We are doing this right now without a self. The self is the illusion of something that isn't what we think it is. It isn't as it appears. And so the teachings say, yes, there is something that appears. It seems like a sense of self. So let's just agree on that. Now, what is the nature of its existence? How does it exist? Because without investigation, it seems to exist in the way we think. It's solid, it's fixed, it's permanent, it's got a soul. It's me. So then it makes sense for me to attach to it, because it's me. But the Buddha said, because of that, we have dukkha. We have samsara. We have human beings, intelligent human beings, who have Buddha nature, who have a fundamentally enlightened mind, acting like monsters, creating evil, actual evil in the world. Cruelty, hatred, and not accidentally, consciously, strategically. That's the pain of the bodhisattva, is to actually see that more and more clearly. The foolishness of how we can be, and yet we have this incredible intelligence, this fundamentally compassionate heart, this capacity to free ourselves, to be a Buddha. Huainong said that there's fundamentally no difference between being an ordinary being, an unenlightened, deluded being, and being an enlightened being. When an ordinary being believes in a sense of self and attaches and strengthens all of those binding emotions and views that cause a lot of trouble for self and other, they start out as a Buddha. They're an enlightened being, but they look out and they see the world is just filled with ordinary human beings. Right? Expendable. A lot of them are just in the way. When an ordinary being frees themselves of that grasping, of those false views, of those attachments, then they look out and they just see a world of Buddhas. And too many acting unknowingly. And so Avalokiteshvara hears the cries of the world, hears the suffering. She's that courageous. But you know, it's not even courage for her. She just hears. She doesn't wake up and think, okay, I'm going to be courageous today. She just wakes up and hears and sees. And she responds. But as we on the path of enlightening ourselves have the heart of Kanon Bodhisattva, but are not quite fully actualized, sometimes we have to wake up and say, okay, be brave. Have courage. Have faith. Don't give up. Everything is possible. Nothing is set. Nothing is fixed. Nothing is permanent. Even in the worst actors, they're suffering. They may know it. They may not. They may care. They may not. They're causing harm, yes. That needs to change, yes. What can I do? Yes. And so we have to vitalize ourselves again and again and again. We have to start over again and again and again. Right? There's a dualistic mind, it's like You know, sort of when I was a kid, teenager, I had friends, there was a big lake in Georgia we used to go to. I had a friend whose family had a boat. So, you know, sometimes we would ski, you know, sometimes we'd tie an inner tube. But why do all of that when you could just hold onto the rope and have the boat drag you through the water? Right? Particularly after you've had a couple beers, right? So we would do that. So it would just drag us through the water, right? You know, and you're just drinking all this water. But then at a certain point, so it's hard, right? Because you're being dragged through the water and the boat's speeding up and they're all laughing. But at a certain point, you start planing and you're just skimming across the water, right? Like a dolphin. Why did I think of that? There was a connection that I have lost. Maybe it has something to do with starting out, you know, having to slog our way through for a while until it gets easier. But, you know, samsara kind of stays the same, but it doesn't. You know, it's kind of like the path itself. I remember sitting in the sendo more than once in a misery, the bottom of a well, dark, alone, waiting to be saved. Nobody was coming to save me. And thinking, oh, this is so hard. I don't know if I can do this. And then I would reflect. It happened a couple of times where I would start thinking about, you know, like, what if I just give it up? You know, go back to what exactly? Was that easier? And every time I thought that, I thought, no, that was hard. That was hard because there was no path. I was just in the bottom of the well, and that was just it. Having a path, it's not the same misery. It kind of feels the same, but it's not. And so to think of ourselves, our own practice that way, think of the world that way. You know, Buddhism, one of the interesting things is for all of its fearless facing of life and death and suffering, of all the things we'd like to avoid, in a way is extremely, I don't know if optimistic is the right word, but really sees human beings as fundamentally on a path towards enlightenment, every human being. Why? Because we have a fundamental aversion for what is destructive of life. And we have a basic affinity for what is a life affirming. And so through successive lifetimes, there's a sense that we are inexorably moving towards the ultimate affirmation of life, which is enlightenment. The total actualization of life and death, the complete embodiment of a liberated being. And that everyone comes along. No one is left out. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And it takes time. It takes time. It takes time within this lifetime. And so that's something that practitioners have to essentially grapple with, right? Because we're not used to that. Like, we'll engage something that's difficult, but there's a very specific goal there. You're basically promised. It's not like that. What you're promised is you have Buddha nature. You have the capacity to do this. And the rest, in a very real sense, is up to you. But, you know, take some traveling partners with you. Makes for a very different journey. And so Buddhism is so perfectly turning towards life, which is now. You know, I said on Friday night, it's the only show in town. Right? And it also has this long view. Right? Because if we just reduce everything to this moment, then everything rides on this moment. You can't fail. You can't misstep. You can't do anything. But if there is an ongoing succession of moments, then when you fall, it's okay. Here's another moment, stand. When you get lost, it's okay. Next moment, find your way back. When you give up on yourself, next moment, find your faith. Dogen said, it's like riding in a boat. You raise the sails and you steer. Although you maneuver the sail and the pole, the boat gives you the ride. So take care of that boat. But it's just a boat. And without the boat, you can't ride. But you ride in the boat, and your riding makes the boat what it is. The boat isn't a thing that you got. It's something we create every day. It's like the boat of this monastery, right? This is a monastery, but where is monastery? Is it in this hall? Is it in the dining room? We create this every day. We're creating it in this moment. It's the boat and your riding that makes it what it is. So he says, investigate such a moment. Examine that, the implications of that. What is actually going on? What is this boat? What is this ride? How am I steering it? At just such a moment, there's nothing but the world of the boat. The sky, the water, the shore are all the boat's world, your world, our world, which is not the same as a world that is not the boat's. There is no other world. Thus, you make life what it is, and you make birth your birth. You make life your life. And this isn't just a matter of, you know, thinking positively. It isn't that with your mind you're literally creating everything, and if you stop thinking, everything is going to disappear into a void. It's not that. It's that the world is what we experience it to be. And if our experiencing of a moment, of every moment, is cloudy, is bound, is fearful, is angry, that's the ride we're getting. But to shift the direction of that boat has to be honest. It has to be genuine. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be happy and not sad. I'm not going to be angry anymore. Try that, right? You will not succeed. And not because you're not trying, not because you're not a good person, because it's not sufficient. We make life what it is. We make birth what it is. And isn't that what's so painful, is when we see people who are in a position to create such a good ride for themselves and other, run it into the shoals. It hurts. It should hurt, right? But to carry that hurt, to bind ourselves to that, becomes paralyzing. And so as practitioners, as you lose your skin, as you increase the capacity to feel, to experience, to engage in dukkha, in suffering, as we are bringing forth compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, equanimity, we have to let go. We have to let go. Right? Otherwise, we'll just go numb again. All right? And so that really works together. Right? So in a sense, as we move more into our lives, the stuff of practice becomes more important, whether we're doing it through the Buddha way or another way, to not cling. Right? It's an essential path. Buddhism doesn't own that. Right? It's not proprietary. It belongs to everyone. So, shall we take advantage of that and spread a little around when you get the opportunity?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.